Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Hello, and welcome to Upstart Crow. I'm William Miller. My guest today is novelist Jung Yoon. We're talking about her new book, her third, All the World Can Hold, from Simon & Schuster. I hope, before we finish, we'll dip a bit into her first two novels as well, Shelter and Oh Beautiful. Welcome, Jung.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I think the most salient point about this novel in terms of starting a discussion is that it opens on September 16th, 2001. That's the Sunday after the events of 9/11, which was a Tuesday. Do you want to tell us why you started there?
Yes. So I should just be upfront about the fact that this book has some closer autobiographical notes than some of my previous work. And on September 16th, 2001, I was living in New York, and I made a decision along with my family to go on a cruise to Bermuda, aboard a ship that was once used as a filming location for the ABC television series, The Love Boat. This was a cruise that had been planned for a while. It was my first and only to date. And I just naturally assumed that after 9/11, we would not go. We would just stay home, which is really what I wanted to do. But we ended up going on that cruise. And the way that the book is structured, it follows the major sections, follow the days of the cruise. And the only real difference is that my cruise was 7 very consequential days out at sea, whereas in the book, it's 5 only.
This seems like a novel that it is based on juxtapositions. You know, I mean, you have the juxtaposition of September 16th, 9/11. You follow largely 3 characters. But you set this up, and if readers haven't seen the cover anywhere advertised, because the book, you know, isn't yet readily available, but I want to draw their attention to the fact that the cover is best viewed upside down.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you saw that. I love that little detail. There's a cruise ship upside down, which I think kind of gets at some of the surrealness of this Winslow Homer painting from his Bermuda series. It's a beautiful image, but the fact that this cruise ship is upside down, very much by design.
Right. Well, when you realize, okay, it's 9/11, it's 2001, and the cover art is upside down, you realize this is all the world can hold. It's the world turned upside down. Then you open the book, and there is, I was reading from an advanced copy, but I assume this didn't change, but you open the book, and one of the first things is, dear readers, is a page that says Sunday, September 16th, depart from New York passenger ship terminal, New York. And that's been crossed through with a single line, Black Falcon Cruise Terminal, Boston. And so you realize this juxtaposition of the world is upside down, but the world is going forward at the same time. The world will go on.
I knew you would be such a lovely reader. And I love that you picked up on that particular distinction. That has not changed in the final printed copy of the book. And again, that is an actual detail that was true to life, which is that the cruise was supposed to depart from the Manhattan Cruise Terminal and everything shut down from the Port Authority. So the cruise ship was rerouted to Boston and we left out of Black Falcon instead. So you can see me sort of trying to hold to some like historical details. And then, you know, once the novel really sort of picks up, moving away from my own personal experiences into the world of these 3 different strangers who decide to go on a cruise themselves.
Okay, so let's talk about these characters, these 3 strangers. They are unto themselves interesting, but when you put them together on the ship, I mean, so the boat becomes kind of like a crucible as we talk about it. I mean, you've got these people's lives. They can't get off the boat except when they're in a harbor. And they interact. But what you do with them, you don't bring them, and I think a lot of lesser writers would, bring them into direct conflict. You don't do that.
No. At most, there are a couple of moments where they sort of glance shoulders off of each other, but they're not really meant to interact and engage in that way. I really like the idea of them being 3 out of, you know, 600 and some passengers on this small cruise ship who don't really see each other, because that's kind of the way that it works in real life. On like some of these really large cruise ships, you can be there for a week or 2 weeks and never see the same people. And the book is kind of structured in a similar way where they're off with their families, with their colleagues, and having the cruise that dictates their experience of the ship. And it's different from what everyone else is experiencing on their own.
You mentioned that this is a kind of, it's a reunion cruise in a sense that people who are fans of this TV show come on to the boat. And there are three stars or people who appeared on the show. The one we're really interested in is a guy named Doug. And he played the kind of everybody likes him bartender on the show.
Yes.
What's his secret? He has a secret.
He has a lot of secrets. I think the one that he's most upfront about is that he has a long history of addiction. And being back on this ship, which was the filming location for his television series, Starlight Voyages, it really stresses him out. It's a form of pressure on him to be back in a place that he associates with the worst of his drug and alcohol use. It's also a place of some of his worst and most notorious behavior. Another secret that he's holding on to is that he was terrible to women in particular at the height of his fame. And in 2001, you know, long before Me Too, he has had his own sort of personal reckoning about his behavior and feels deeply regretful and grief-stricken about the ways in which he used people, particularly women. He is someone who believes that he dragged a lot of others down a spiral that maybe some of them didn't get out of like he did. And he has one other secret that involves kind of a lost love that he has been carrying around for an incredibly long time and has never recovered from, that he also feels quite guilty and regretful about his behavior and his role in the end of that relationship. And again, you know, he's a person who is kind of a washed up actor, and he needs to keep up his, you know, SAG, his credits to keep his health insurance. He does not want to be on this reunion cruise, but it is the best possible paycheck that he can get. So he is definitely on the ship under duress.
And being on the ship means he's got to confront these demons.
Absolutely.
And because he's on the ship cruising to Bermuda from Boston, it's not like he can escape these demons.
No.
This is what we call a crucible story. You can't escape, right?
Exactly. And, you know, the demons are both in human form. They're former cast members who remember who he was. And they're also, you know, memories that are deeply embedded within just like walking the halls of the ship and seeing former spaces and having these sort of hazy memories of what he might have done there.
And then there's Lucy. Lucy wasn't supposed to be on this trip, but she was invited by a roommate, her landside roommate, mm-hmm. Mariah. And Lucy's like an overachiever.
Yes, very much so.
She doesn't have demons, except, I mean, she does have demons, but they're not the same demons that Doug has.
She is a very talented young woman who can do pretty much anything with her life. She just doesn't want to do the things that she has trained her life to do. She's in the process of finishing up a doctoral program at MIT. And, you know, the world is really her oyster in 2001. She can have a career in tech. She can have a career in government. She can do a lot of different things, but she doesn't want to do any of those particular things. She really wants to paint. But Lucy is someone who has been brought up by a Black middle-class family who has given her a particular message all of her life, which is get a good education, get a good job, make money, be stable, have a family, you know, which is really the dream that her parents had. And they've imposed that dream on her and raised her to chase it. And she's done that really well. It's just not the dream that she has for herself. So when readers meet Lucy for the first time, she does not even believe that she has allowed herself to be dragged onto this ship. It's so unlike her to be that spontaneous. And it's also a very busy period of time in the recruitment season back home in Cambridge. So she's just kind of dazed, thinking like, what am I doing here? Why am I here? And of course, she's there because it's a great place to hide out and kind of avoid all the decisions that it feels like she has to make very soon.
Including the big one of, you know, A, finding a job and a home for herself and that kind of thing. But also, is she going to go for the artsy side of herself, or is she going to go for the practical side that her parents are driving? Or is she going to try to find some happy medium within herself that satisfies both pieces of her psyche?
Yeah, I love Lucy. I love all of these characters, actually. I was telling somebody recently that I just kind of miss being with them every day, which is, you know, what the process of a book is like. I spent every day for nearly 3 years thinking about and writing about these people, and they feel, you know, more like people to me as a result.
Let me stick with that line for just a moment. You said you were on a cruise in 2001, but you must have, in a sense, lived with these characters in your head and heart from 2001 until you began the book 3 years ago.
I did, but I never thought of them as three different characters. I think in many ways, Franny and Doug and Lucy represent like three different parts of who I was as a person in 2001, you know, someone who was not happy with my career and not happy within my own relationships and feeling like I was hiding parts of my own sort of desire to be living a different kind of life than I was professionally, wanting to move more toward art than I was actually able to do in my real life. So while I never thought of them as three characters, once they started developing, I realized, oh, these are three different parts of me back then that I'm sort of working out on the page.
I guess we won't go too much, you know, pull up the couch and have you, you know, lean back and tell.
I feel like I almost, in some ways, I have just by like writing about them. But they didn't appear to me as three characters. I think Franny was the first to appear. And that's easy because she's a Korean-American woman. She's there with her family. And then the other two characters, I kind of played into the structural element of the Love Boat series, which always had three storylines, you know, one too dramatic and then one was a bit more lighthearted. And I thought, oh, what an interesting way of getting more characters like into this mix and to be able to focus the lens on more than just Franny. And that's how Doug and Lucy came into the picture.
Yeah, but where's the lighthearted one?
There's not a directly lighthearted one, but I do think that a cruise ship is such a strange and surreal place that there are sort of lighthearted, sort of fun and funny moments that happen. But there, you're right. There's not a distinctly lighthearted, funny, ha-ha storyline in the three.
I think there is Mariah, who is the woman who brings Lucy on this cruise and is her roommate. She's so over the top that she's kind of there for comedic relief, I think. Or at least I got some comedic relief from her.
That's great. She's like fun and funny and flighty. And Lucy's just having a heck of a time, like kind of keeping up with her energy, which makes the space of the ship feel more confining because, you know, they're in a room together.
That's right. And like we said, Crucible, you can't just jump off and start swimming.
Exactly.
And you mentioned Franny. I hadn't brought her up yet because I was kind of, in a sense, saving Franny for last. Franny and her husband, Tom, there's some of the most beautiful writing about Franny and Tom and in their dialogue back and forth. And I don't think it gives too much away about the novel to say that Franny was in New York the day that the planes hit and that the towers collapsed. And she was close enough to have a personal experience.
Yes.
And your evocation of that, everybody who wants to be a writer should go read that evocation.
Oh, that's so kind. That's really, really kind. Thank you.
Well, most of us tend to overwrite and that kind of a scene. And the reason I say this is because you scoped it down, you made it very personal, and you, what I would call, underwrote it. And the strength is in that technique.
Yeah. I think that that was always one of my concerns about writing a 9/11 related novel. I think one of the reasons why this book had such a long incubation period is that every time I attempted to write any sort of story about 9/11, it turned out to be very directly about 9/11. And I ended up doing the sort of overwriting that the book I was trying to avoid. I think other writers have written books that are more squarely about the event. And I really wanted the story that I was telling to be focused on characters who are responding to the event and how they respond and how they go on afterwards. So yeah, I'm glad you noticed. Thank you.
You may have read and paid more close attention than I did. I don't think writers have dealt a lot with 9/11. I just don't think that we have. In other words, in 2002, on the 9/11 anniversary, I was asked at George Mason to talk to a group, a large enrolled student group, for a class of English majors, and it was 9/11. And the instructor for this large enrolled class was trying to figure out, you know, what do we do about it being 9/11? And so I don't know why they asked me, of all the people they could have asked, but my conjecture at that date was that it's going to take us a long time to write effectively about 9/11. So that's my kind of bias, if you will. I haven't seen much representation and much effective representation of those events and the aftermath, if you will.
You know, I read a couple of novels that are more focused on the event that I wanted to be. And I read them just because I wanted to see examples of people and how they depicted the event on the page. So the one that comes to mind first and foremost is Falling Man by Don DeLillo. And then another is Jess Walter's The Zero, both of which are absolutely beautiful books, but definitely not the kind of book that I wanted to write. I found myself sort of gravitating more to Claire Massoud's The Emperor's Children, in which there's a reference to 9/11, but the novel is very much about the characters and not about the event. So I appreciated that particular approach. It just took me a long time to realize that, one, that was the approach that I wanted to take, and then, two, finding the actually like entry point. I resisted the idea of setting the book on a cruise ship for the longest time. And of course, like once I actually did it, the writing just kind of took off from there.
Why did you resist it? I have to ask. Was it too close to the biography?
Too close. I think that that was the biggest aversion to it initially. And then I thought, a novel that takes place on a cruise ship? Like, what the heck is that? I couldn't think of a book, one, that did that. And two, I always just thought of cruise ships as being kind of like, you know, humorous and fun and funny and kind of surreal. And that didn't feel right tonally. But then I thought about it. Eventually, I realized, like, that's exactly what I was doing. And that was part of my emotional sort of disconnect. Like, it just felt like we were in the wrong place at the wrong point in history. But once I started thinking more and more about that sense of discomfort and the disconnect that I felt being away at sea for those 7 days, it's like, oh, that's probably the thing I should be writing about.
Well, there was that one novel long, long ago, Ship of Fools.
Yes.
You begin with Franny and Tom being shown their suite on board. And that's where the, if you will, the mundane and the frightful parts kind of begin to creep in together. Because as the book says, there is this very nice guy who is, you know, showing them how everything works and where everything is and doing his thing. And it's just so normal. And Franny's has looked at his name tag and, you know, and said, well, that can't really be his name because his name wouldn't be that from the country he's from. And of course, that is very cruise ship lore that, you know, the anglicizing of the name. So there you have that normalcy. But then Tom is desperate for news. And we don't know at that point why, but he's desperate for news of what's going on and what's the situation. Are they finding bodies? Like that kind of mass news is going to answer his very personal question.
Yeah. I feel like the beginning of a novel always takes me so much longer than the end. And just trying to figure out, like, what is the pacing and the cadence and how do people talk to each other and how long does a scene or a section, like, how long do I want them to sort of breathe on the page? That opening chapter just took such a long time. But one of the things that I really enjoy about it is that initially a reader, they open the book, they see it's September 16th, but they don't know what year it is. And then they see this couple. And at first, like the husband just seems like he's just terrible. Like he's being rude to the person from guest services who's showing them around. He seems really frantic and anxious. And he seems impolite in a way that his wife is not. And then once we realize the timing of this particular scene, I hope have a moment where we think, oh, actually, maybe the husband is the one who's being sort of reasonable in this moment, wanting to see the news, wanting to know what's going on in the world. But the wife is the one who's acting a little bit irrationally, being so like, okay, here we are, we're on vacation, we're on this cruise, let's listen to this man talk about the minibar. So yeah, it took a long time to get to that particular scene, but that really felt like the right way of introducing readers to the dynamic that is Franny and Tom.
Well, and we should say why Franny insisted they come on this cruise, because this is a major piece of their story.
Yes, it is Franny's mother's 70th birthday, which in Korean culture, it's called the Chilsun. It's a big event. In Korean culture, we celebrate the 60th, 70th, 80th, 90th birthdays of our elders, and they're a really big festive deal. They are a moment to bring together family, and if people have the resources to really sort of spend some money to show everyone, well, like, look what a good life this person has led. Like, look at their children and how grateful they are and how much they want to signal that to their parent. So Franny, despite the timing of the cruise, has absolutely insisted in a way that she never has before in her marriage that they are going to honor this date. They are going to go on this cruise. They are going to have this birthday party for her mother. And Tom is there begrudgingly.
Well, but Tom says, I mean, in his defense, like I'm going to be his trial lawyer here or something. He says to Franny, somewhat accurately, you and your mom don't even get along that well. And she doesn't seem like she's going to appreciate this.
Yep. But it doesn't stop Franny from trying. You know, that's just part of her relationship with her mother. She keeps trying and she keeps getting it wrong. And she doesn't understand the ways in which she's getting it wrong. But it doesn't stop her from trying.
One of the things that I admire about your novels is that you are not afraid to let your characters mess up. And also, you invest your characters with the seeds of their own undoing.
Thank you. Yeah, I definitely try. I love a good, fallible, often kind of unlikable character. I like lighting a pretty long fuse for things to eventually go wrong. I think that there are a lot of fuses I lit early in each of these characters' chapters when we first meet them and kind of kept them going for as long as I possibly could until there was, you know, so much pressure, there had to be some sort of like impact and explosion. That has always been kind of fun for me, thinking about long threads.
We probably should kind of leave Franny's relationship with her mother there and let the readers go discover it for themselves. But I'm tempted to sort of say, this fits within character for Franny and is a kind of denial.
Yes.
It's a motif of hers.
Very much so. And, you know, I think she is a person who is just trying to go along to get along with the rest of her family and her life on land. You know, she's a lawyer. She has things to do. She's busy. It leads to a lot of distraction. But when she's on this ship and she's confronted with her husband and her mother and her brother and his girlfriend, it makes it really hard to avoid thinking about the things that aren't going well in her life and the relationships that are frayed or just simply not working. It makes it much harder to avoid or ignore the things that she can more easily ignore when she's, you know, back in her regular world.
Well, and Tom's also a lawyer, but he took the easy way. He works for his dad's company, the development company.
Mm-hmm.
And he has no ambition.
He's just rich.
Yeah, but he didn't earn it.
Nope, he's just rich.
He's just rich, which is a rich characterization. But are you one of those writers who has a lot of backstory? I mean, they've only been married for how long? Like 3 years or something like that, right?
Yeah, they've been together for 5 total. So yeah, it's not a long relationship, but it's the longest one she's had.
But they're not really super young either. I mean, they're both lawyers. They're pursuing careers and stuff. I found myself wondering how they met and what kind of social life they had before they stumbled into each other.
Classic iceberg theory, right?
Yeah.
A lot that's underneath the surface and a lot that I've sort of journaled or outlined about them. I'd put them in a lot of different scenes of sort of like, I did write a dating scene, not because I ever wanted to include a dating scene, a full-length dating scene in the actual novel, but I do think it's helpful for me to kind of understand, like, how do these two people that we see in these chapters who are clearly not happy with each other, how do they ever think that they would be happy with each other? And, you know, that awkward sort of first date setup is really like about manners and, you know, two people who have been well educated and, you know how to professionally interact and, you know, they're doing the thing that people do when they're on a blind date and getting to know each other and liking just enough of the answers to continue on.
I can see why you would write that scene, but I can also see why you wouldn't put it in the novel because it would take you off the boat.
Absolutely. Yeah. But good to write nonetheless.
And I sort of say we are left not knowing, but on the other hand, I don't think they know.
Yeah. I mean, she eventually kind of figures out why she's willing to accept his kind of ersatz version of love. But that comes later on. He has some of his own reasons, but none of these are particularly good reasons to build a life with another person. And I think it comes out in their interactions with each other, which are not loving and not particularly caring.
Right. One of your comedic aspects in this book was him in his shorts.
Yeah. I mean, you've seen it before, right?
Like, oh, yeah.
Suddenly the weather gets warmer and you see all these people coming out who have clearly not seen any sunshine for a really long time. Tom in his shorts.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. But it also was a tipping point. She knew he hadn't gone and played golf when he didn't get sunburned legs.
Exactly.
You made mention a few moments ago about opening scenes being something that you concentrated on. I want to turn our attention for a moment to your first novel, Shelter, and the opening scene there. I mean, for readers who haven't read that scene, that novel, they should, I don't know, go get it and read it. Now I say that, but now I'm going to sort of talk about it. So here we have our guy who is over his head in terms of finances, and he's got a house that he is paying for but can't pay for. It's such a sweet moment. His little boy comes and he wants to play a game on TV or watch TV or something, and the remote doesn't work or whatever. So he comes looking for batteries, and his dad gets up, our character gets up and gets him batteries and gets him going. And then the guy goes back to his bedroom, and his wife, you know, tells him that the real estate agent is coming that morning, and he's been trying to dodge the real estate agent. And the real estate agent shows up. And she's touring around and she's telling him what she thinks about the house and what it can get and all the shortcomings of the house and stuff like that. And they're sort of strategizing about, you know, how to sell, when to sell, where to live in the meantime. And she looks out the back window and she's like horrified. It's like one of those, oh my God, moments. Our chief character's mother is running toward the house across the field and she's naked.
Mm-hmm. And that moment happens 10 pages into the final printed book, which is something that I really try to do in all of my long form fiction. I want to just get in there. You know, my husband and I are very different readers, and he will sometimes try to hand me a book about like moss for something. And he's like, you know, by 100 pages, it'll get really good. I'm like, I don't want to wait 100 pages for something to really start to happen. So with Shelter, it was important to me that we go from this like kind of slow, typical domestic kind of scene into something like really unsettling and uncomfortable in pretty short order. So yeah, that also had a very, very long incubation period because I remember, you know, thinking about the idea of a man washing dishes at his kitchen window and his elderly mother is walking toward the house naked. I thought about that like my first or second year in grad school, but didn't know what that was all about and didn't know that I had a story to wrap around it, much less to start a story with until many, many years later.
Is that frequently the case with you that you get a scene like that that comes and you then put the story together with it?
Yes, that happens quite often. And then I'll like jot some lines down or maybe get a couple of pages down and then realize that I don't have enough to make it a story. But, you know, I always tell my students, like, keep everything. You absolutely don't know when some of the things that you've put like in your graveyard of old texts might actually have a reason to come into its own. So lots and lots of images, lots of scraps of ideas and scenes. I don't know what it all adds up to. And sometimes I just go back and revisit to see if I could make something of these ideas now.
It's the best reason for composing on a computer, right? Oh, that paragraph, go back. Oh, that scene.
Yes.
Copy, paste. I got a whole new story.
Exactly. If I did it on paper, my gosh, one, my handwriting's illegible, but two, that'd just be so much paper.
That novel goes on about the family and their house has been broken into, destroyed, that of our guy's parents. And so the note about the novel says, all of a sudden, the family's kind of compressed together under one roof. It's kind of a crucible story again.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, in many ways, I am always writing about the same thing. Like, all three of these books, like, I understand that a common thread that runs through all of them is the idea of disaster, sort of man-made disaster, whether it's a housing market crisis, whether it's an oil boom and bust, whether it's 9/11. I'm always writing and thinking about disaster and the way that people respond to it, particularly when you put them into these sort of pressurized situations and you really just take the screws to them and see how they respond to those kinds of stimuli. So, you know, I'm writing about my own obsessions, and I guess I'm just kind of obsessed with the idea of the disasters that we create for ourselves.
Right. Well, and I think that's the key point, is the disasters we create for ourselves as opposed to those things that happen to us. The other novel, I mean, since we sort of got into this talking about beginnings, the first line of Oh Beautiful is just, it is a first line that begs to read the whole novel. Men talk to her on planes. How could you quit reading at that point?
That's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had a lot of conversations with women who have made the mistake of picking up my book and reading that first chapter while they're on a plane. I'm like, I'm so sorry. So sorry. Don't read it on a plane.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I think it works. Well, but I'm not a woman, so maybe, you know. But I usually only fly with my wife, and I do talk to her on the plane. But was that the first line you wrote?
Actually, I think that may have been the first and the original line that I wrote. But I did write, how did I forget this? I wrote like a completely different shadow novel of Oh Beautiful, which was actually, they were interconnected short stories about people living around a community that was, you know, watching this oil boom unfold. And because oil booms bring together this like kind of wild cast of characters from all over, I originally tried to write Oh Beautiful as these short stories that focused each story on a particular person. And I wrote, I want to say 6 or 7 of them about a whole bunch of different people before I finally landed on Eleanor Hansen, who is the main character of the final version of Oh Beautiful. And because she is a journalist slash writer, and she's returning to a place that she's pretty familiar with, she ended up being kind of like the perfect lens through which to filter the changes that have taken place in a community that she knows well. And also, you know, because she's a woman in an environment that is dominated predominantly by itinerant male oil workers, she can sort of be that person who registers the sense of threat that one might feel being, you know, the lone woman surrounded by, you know, all these men.
This is the oil boom novel that you referred to a few moments ago. It's Oh Beautiful. It may not be clear from the title that that's what we're talking about.
Right.
I like the fact that all along she has the sense that there's some deeper story that she should be looking for, and she's not finding it. And the people she's talking to aren't the story that she thinks she needs to be tracking for. And meanwhile, it's like her life is on two different planes, if you will, you know, planes of existence, where she's following the story she thinks she was sent there to do. And she's also trying to nose into the story that her gut tells her is the real story.
Yes. And, you know, Eleanor is, I should mention for context, she is in her early 40s. She is having like a second career as a writer. But before that, she used to be a model, but not a very successful one. She's like the kind of model who does like suntan lotion and, you know, appears on the covers of like sewing patterns. She was just pretty enough by someone's standards to get by. But now she's doing something completely different, having a hard time getting people to talk to her. She's really too green for the story that she was sent out there to report, and definitely too green for the story that she thinks she's trying to tell. So that allowed for some like productive tension and a couple of like curveballs in terms of her kind of figuring out her own way while she's out there.
She is too green.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's not without ambition, which is great, but she's definitely green and also just completely lacks self-confidence, which makes a sense of inexperience like even worse. She doesn't have a lot of faith in herself, in part because she has never gotten messages from others that she is someone who really has like the sort of chops to be successful at what she's doing. She has been a pretty face for a very, very long time.
There's an instructor who sort of sets her up with this assignment.
Yes.
And he knows how green she is.
Yes. Yes. And he has some ulterior motives for, you know, giving her this plum job. You know, at first he says it's because you're from there. You're from North Dakota. It's good to send somebody who knows the terrain back. And, you know, she's just so desperate for work and, you know, hungry for an opportunity to prove herself. She also has all of his notes. Like, he's kind of like baby feeding her the article that he wants her to write. And when she gets there, she's like, this isn't the story.
Right. Exactly. As I was saying, yeah. Definitely a book people should get and read. Let's go back to Shelter for a second. There's a car crash in that scene. I mean, in that novel. There's a car crash scene in that novel. It blew me away. I won't say I wasn't expecting it. When it happened, I sort of like, okay, I get that. In a sense, in the pacing of the novel, the rising tension of the novel, it felt appropriate. But in terms of the characters and what was lost, I really felt badly for them.
That actually makes me feel good that you felt bad.
Yeah, you had me.
Well, I mean, that book was a lot of the chatter that I had from editors when the book was being shopped around. It's like, it's so sad. It's so sad. And Kyung is so terrible. Like, a lot of the feedback that I got was like, can you lighten up a little bit? So I did lighten up a little bit and made efforts to make Kyung a little bit more likable. But I was never intending for him to be. It was very clear when an editor and I were just not meant to be, you know, partners to each other, because I could only take him so far before I started to lose what felt right for the book. I did have conversations with some editors about that particular car crash scene and wanted to keep it. And the reason why I knew my editor, Elizabeth Bruce at Picador, was the right person is that she was the one who explicitly and openly acknowledged that sometimes life can be really dark. And sometimes sad, desperate people do sad and desperate things, which is what I saw that car crash as being all about.
Right. Yeah, I'll give you both of those, that life can be dark and sad and desperate people do sad and desperate things. It is all about pacing, right? It's all about building up to something like that. And I think the novel does that. Just my personal sense is that it built to that point. And then what happens after that feels like it's also appropriate. And if you didn't have that kind of moment, that kind of high drama, I don't know that you could have had. If the editor said, let's take this out, did they have any suggestions for where you go?
No, of course not. That was also like part of my difficulty taking out something that was hugely necessary for structural, just like plain structural purposes. And of course, like, you know, when people give those types of comments, they think they're doing you a favor by not like being more prescriptive about how to fix it. But the amount of damage that a change like that makes, that's a lot of fixing.
That's a year of rewriting.
I mean, it's a sea change that takes us away from how I wanted the book to end and how I wanted it to land. So, you know, sometimes a change was just too much.
So what are you working on now?
Oh, gosh. We're very close to the publication of this third book, and I have started thinking about the fourth. And again, it is about sort of my obsession about disaster. This time it's sort of a pandemic-related novel. It may be sort of leaning speculative fiction territory, which is new for me. But yeah, it's about aging and the pandemic and, you know, sort of the questions about the responsibilities that we have to take care of each other, to eradicate disease, and the kinds of lengths that we will go to be able to do those types of things.
I know writers who say, no, when a novel's coming out, you know you're going to be on tour, you're going to be doing podcasts, you're going to be, you know, focusing on that one. It's not a good time to start. But I know other writers who say, you got to at least lay out a bit of it and have something in your head so that you don't have that, for want of a better term, postpartum moment when you get back to your, you know, your writing space and you're off the tour and people aren't talking to you and you're not the hum of everybody's activity and you go, who am I? What do I do?
Yeah, you know, I wish I could be one of those people who could actually do like real writing. At this point, like I'm just like taking notes and doing research and thinking about what it is that I want to write. I don't have as many pages down, but at least when the activity around this third book is done. Like, I know where my compass is pointed and where I want to go next. And I'm just like eager to have that time. I just know I'm not going to get it for a little bit.
Well, but I think, you know, the idea of meaning and work to do and that kind of thing is what we all need, right? You got to have that in front of you when you get back to that space that you're in.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for taking the time today to talk with me. This has been a great delight. And whatever that next project is, I will guarantee you that there is one eager fan out there waiting for it. I don't know who he is, but you know, I'm sure he's at least one.
Thank you so much for doing this, Bill. I know that you have like this long history of being a writer and a teacher. And I always look forward to these kinds of conversations because I feel like the kind of closeness of the reading, it's just different with some folks. So I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Your feedback helps others find the show. You can also watch full episodes and clips from Upstart Crow on our YouTube channel. Be sure to follow us on social media and visit upstartcrow.org for more information about our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of those links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio.